Okay, I'm Alan Farmer, retired from St Martin's College, Lancaster, 3 years ago. I was then head of history and geography, and I've done a bit of teaching since then, but I'm still writing history textbooks. Is that sufficient?
That's great, thanks.
Good.
Can you tell me about your own educational background and why you decided to study history and become a history teacher?
Who knows, Nicola? I always used to ask questions, probably ask you if I interviewed you, whether an interest in history was genetic or social, and still don't really know the answer. It's a bit of both, isn't it? There's certainly nothing very much in the family that's historical, so presumably more social. Always enjoyed history, even at primary school, as I remember, and that interest must have come from somewhere. Films, comics, books, visits. But not specifically mum and dad. Secondary school, I did have a very attractive 24-year-old blonde when I was 11. Perhaps that...
Your history teacher?
Yeah, he also taught geography. Miss Cox went on to become a teacher trainer. I enjoyed history, was good at history. That said, I was probably better at maths, and I was pretty good all-rounder. And when I had to decide options, I was kind of put a stream ahead. It was grammar school I went to for A-level. Didn't do history O-level. Never done history O-level. I went straight on to A-level. But I could have gone the science, maths, science route, but instead went the history, geography, English lit route. Would have been better doing history, geography and maths, but had to do English and enjoy that at A-level more than history. Got the A-levels a year early, had nothing to do for a year, so actually went teaching. This is 1967, they were short of teachers. So went straight from school one day into teaching the next. Year six, 11-year-olds, in a tough part of Sheffield. Class of 35, and I had them to myself for Goodness. Two terms. You couldn't do that
nowadays,
but it was great. Chief Education Officer's twins were in the class, but I had no idea what a Chief Education Officer was, so that didn't worry me at all. The main problem was trying to work out which twin was which. That was great. Then on to university, Nottingham, got a first, started PhD, decided I didn't like the loneliness of it, although it was going reasonably well, I guess. So thought about accountancy, because I got an uncle who was an accountant partner, but dropped the PhD and had to do something else for a few months, so got the job straight away as head of history, which was again barmy, in an 11 to 16 school, again tough part of Sheffield, and went straight in as head of history without any training. There was myself and a South African king, George Mbeeli, who'd escaped house arrest in South Africa, and the two of us were in charge of history in this school, and did our best to teach history, which was great. So I did that for best part of a year.
So you did teach training here?
Yeah, I did, because come the end I could have continued at the school. Decided I was thoroughly enjoying myself. Got the job in the accountancy firm, but decided I didn't want to do that. I did apply for BBC, and got on a shortlist of sorts, but they decided they didn't want me. So BBC didn't want me, I didn't want accountancy, and therefore I was quite happy to stick with history teaching, and thought if I'm going to stick with this, I'd better get the PGC. Not that you needed one at that stage, but I thought, well, it'd be interesting to go and get a bit of tuition as to what I should be doing rather than what I've been doing. So that was, I guess, the background to becoming a history teacher.
And where did you train then?
Trained in Sheffield, not at the university, at City College, partly because I applied very late, I think, and probably the university had no places at that stage, because I wasn't going to go into history teaching at all at one stage.
So where did you get your first job then after that?
First job was at Myers Grove, which is a massive, comprehensive, biggest school in Sheffield and one of the biggest in Britain. 2,000 kids, big history department, 7 or 8 I guess, good good morale among the staff, good camaraderie. Was there for 3 years, rose to second in department, and then went to a set of history to a school called Freshfield School, which is since gone. It's amalgamated with other schools, and was there until the end of 1984. So I was head of history, and then kind of, as you do, as you were telling me, your career, became head of humanities, I think, and then head of sixth form. And by 1984 was seeking to advance further, I guess.
And so that led directly or naturally into teacher training?
Well, yeah, I guess it did, albeit there weren't many teacher training jobs circa 1984, so the obvious way forward, I guess, seemed to be deputy head. I had one or two interviews on that score. I didn't really want to be deputy head because I did really like history. I guess if I'd have wanted management and all of that, I would have gone more into the kind of accountancy way of things way back. Always liked history and always liked teaching history. Never really liked the management side of things, albeit most of my life seems to have been involved in more management than history. It's a way of the world, I guess. 1984, applied for this, that, and failed at this and that on the deputy head front, but applied to St Martin's and got the job there, starting very early in 1985.
So when you were teaching all those years in Sheffield, was your approach to teaching developing as you went on? Was it something you started with and stuck with? Did you learn from your teacher training?
I'll answer your first one first. I'm not sure I learned a great deal from the teacher training, because I think the teacher training was a bit scared about me, really, because I don't think he'd got any real experience in a comprehensive school, or even a pretty tough school, whereas I'd obviously taught for the best part of a year, and therefore had experiences that the poor chap who was supposed to be teaching me hadn't got. So I think he was a bit in awe of me rather than me of him. But all teacher training is, I mean, it's valuable because you meet other folk, not necessarily the people who are doing the training, you meet other people in your position. So you learn a lot from sharing experiences with them about their experience in school. And you learn a lot about teaching in different schools because you build up experiences from place to place and from class to class. And every class is different. So it was useful in the sense that I saw another two or three schools and met other folk that I became friendly with who were history teachers. On the job, yeah, learned a considerable amount at Myers Grove because there were seven or eight historians, all older than me, but mainly young. It was a go-ahead department, very go-ahead. With school history materials and visions and aspirations to be very innovative. So I learned a lot there.
When you say you're referring to the school's history project?
Yeah. That was coming in early 70s, but Myers Grove was there at the start with the materials and anxious to pursue that. I'm not sure I was one of the great evangelical school history folk, but like some of its approaches, so I was in early with that. Freshville, small department of two or three, and perhaps you become a little bit more set in your ways. Plus history wasn't the only job, it was more the kind of management of others as well as the teaching of history, and you know, as you going to one job, the other job pales a bit. But you're always learning in with regard to history teaching, with regard to teaching fully. I think you should be. I'm not sure, but you must be. You every class is a different organism, whatever the word is. But you know what I mean. It's different. Mm. It's the same way that an actor must feel with an audience. That every audience is different. So you're putting on a similar act, but you can be inspired or not by the by the audience. Perhaps not a very good analogy, but I'm sure you know what I mean.
When you were teaching her at Myers
Grove.
Grove in the 70s, what were the big ideas coming into history? Just schools history project or other things as well?
A lot of emphasis on local history. At that stage, there was... it had just been... I mean, Rosler was not far away, so you got these children who were would have left way back in the 60s, who you now had to educate, entertain, interest. We did have a kind of good local history. CSE syllabus, I guess, for them. So there's quite a lot of forward thinking on that with today they'd be called special needs, I suppose, kids, which involve a lot of visits and ways of approach. So that was a bit, I guess, avant-garde. But otherwise, school's history and a kind of inquiry, history mystery detective approach was probably about it, as far as my memory is concerned.
What about the O-level and A-level classes?
They weren't taught... I mean, A-level was taught pretty traditionally, I guess, and... O-level... I mean, the exam was traditional, but that didn't mean to say that the teaching of O-level was in any ways necessarily traditional, because to get good O-level results, I always felt, I think a lot of those I worked with felt that you had to interest, motivate, stimulate the kids, so... Albeit the final way of assessment was pretty dull as dishwater. The teaching was always good fun, and that was always, you're always trying to be a little bit innovative in terms of how you interested and motivated. In some respects, those times the more interesting bit was CSE, because we both at Myers Grove and then at Freshall did introduce CSE. Syllabuses, which you could do, rather than just take one from a board, you could invent your own. So at Myers Grove, we invented one or two. We invented the kind of local history one, but then we did a more mainstream one for those who were just below the O-level, but who could get the grade one, and that was regarded similarly to an O-level. So we did that, and I took that to Freshfield and modified it a little bit. So that was quite interesting. I'm not sure it was innovative, because a lot of folk were doing the same kind of thing at that time.
Mm-hmm. So you've written that you prefer content to skills where history in school is concerned.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what's your view about the SHP approach to learning history? Because that emphasises skills.
Yeah. Did write with Peter Knight, this active history. Peter was totally against the word skill. As a word in history terms, he liked the word procedure. Didn't think skills meant anything at all. I've said I was there, fully aware of SHP from the outset. Did have some good materials like the history mystery approach. But there's a book coming, a major book coming. I think it was a bit too evangelical in some respects, a bit too didactic. Indeed, some of its materials are a bit too didactic, i.e. you will all teach this, and I think it did itself a disservice by almost ignoring content. I mean, at one stage Mark Pullen was probably better known than Winston Churchill, and that could not in any respect be right. That can't be right. History, there was a danger that history would, the baby would go down with the bathwater or something. Its materials were could easily chain you, I think, to and the experience were very expensive. If you didn't get in at the start, you probably couldn't afford those materials. They'd chain you to a set of form of teaching that was not necessarily the best way to teach. He got rid of the story approach, or you could get rid of the story approach, and because of the materials that we used, and story is as well as the inquiry approach, story's always been, you know, story or inquiry. Well, it's a bit of both. History, good history teaching has got to be a bit of both, and schools history could forget the story side, which I think is sad. Not sure that the school's history material was really suitable for poor kids, and I've taught an awful lot of poor kids.
You mean poor background?
Poor academically. Oh, the less able kids found a lot of the materials difficult. Now, yes, you could, and at Myersgrove we did, and at Freshwell, I think I continued that a bit. You did try and water down the ideas that school history pioneered. You could have plenty of history mysteries, but of course history mysteries weren't new. They didn't come in with SHP. I remember at grammar school when I was being taught, there were all kinds of history mysteries. Indeed, that was a common way forward in the 50s and 60s, so this wasn't new. Perhaps a bit of a fetish as well for primary sources. I don't think primary sources are necessarily that interesting for young kids. The language levels can be very difficult. Not sure why there should be a fetish for primary sources. I mean, real historians, if that's what SHP was about, doing what real historians do. Most real historians don't necessarily play with primary sources. Most of them get to know the secondary sources first before they mess around with the primary sources. So perhaps it was a bit of an emperor's new clothes job, SHP. But it was a way forward. It wasn't a bad way forward, apart from the way that content, in a sense, was put on the back burner, or might have been. I think in reality it wasn't. I think most schools were very sensible in terms of people I met throughout the 70s and early 80s who were teaching. They took some of the ideas of SHP, which were good ideas, and some of the materials were good, and played with those rather than took the whole thing. Of course, if you're doing it at O level, later GCSE, I suppose you had to take their package, but their package wasn't bad as a GCSE package. It was good to teach too. I never did it once, but enjoyed it.
Do you think that when you say you sacrifice the story, are you referring to simply the interest of stories or the idea of there being a thread of development, a storyline throughout
history?
Yeah,
it's a good question. No, I'm talking about the specific, you can't teach the whole of history, so I'm talking about the multitude of smaller stories that make up history. Now, SHP didn't mean to say you wouldn't necessarily lose a story, because good history teachers would tell the story and use a kind of SHP approach, but there was a danger, because of the nature of the materials, that the story approach could get lost, and all you do is set kids to work with primary materials that weren't necessarily always that engaging, and lose the story element, which is still basic, I think, to good history. I mean, history is a bit like, it is like newspapers, isn't it? It's newspapers are present history, in a sense, and they have a story.
And an interpretation.
And an interpretation, yeah.
So is it the teacher should give the interpretation to the pupil?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think a teacher almost inevitably will give an interpretation, because even if they simply present case for and case against, they are actually choosing the materials that they'll put case for and case against, so there will be some kind of bias probably creeping in. But you can do it reasonably objectively, and historians usually try their best to be as objective as they can. Interpretation, I think one of the great things about history, whether you're telling a story or not, is that the kind of interpretation, kids love it. If you say, well, this is one, but there is another, and there may even be a third, and I think that's all part of the stories of history. It's not just the story of history. There are many different stories of history. But out of those stories, you get some kind of consensus about what did happen. think.
I remember you once saying that you didn't see what all the fuss was about because 99% of history was agreed upon.
I think that would have been overstating the case. What I might have been trying to, that would have been massively overstating the case. What I would have perhaps been trying to say would be that you can be too relativist, there was a battle of Hastings. Yeah, I know you can be ever so relativist there. You know, it wasn't 1066 and it wasn't much of a battle and it wasn't at Hastings and so on. But 1066 something did happen, and I think there will be considerable consensus about what went on. There will be debates about precisely what caused the Normans to invade. There will be massive debates about what caused the English defeat, and there'll be massive debates about what followed. But nevertheless, the core is fixed, that the Normans did come in 1066 if you adopt the present BCAD system of dating. And there's an awful lot of consensus about that kind of hard fact. It's a bit like I love sport. In fact, you're privileged because we're not watching the cricket in the background. But, you know, if you watch any kind of sport, yeah, you can interpret this, that. But there's a hard core of fact, as well as the interpretation of that fact. So 99%. No, I'm sure I didn't ever say that. If I did, I must have had too much to drink. But there is, I'm sure, a hard core of fact. I don't want to define fact, but I think there's... got to accept that, otherwise you can't accept anything really, I think. And we are all then totally and utterly islands. We can't even have a conversation about anything because your toothache's not the same as mine, and every word is different, so I think we're lost then as a society and as people.
That's very profound.
It's not at all.
We move on to GCSE. Did you think that was
Yes, that's a good thing. That's a good thing in 1066 terms. Yeah, I think so. And that, in part, arises from school history. So I may have sounded anti-school history, but I think school history, in many respects, served a good purpose. I just think perhaps it went over for a while. It was perhaps the evangelicals, who had considerable power within the history fraternity, and perhaps were a bit too blinkered in the direction that they were setting history upon. I think GCSE was generally a good thing in my view. It adopted many of the best approaches of school history. It by and large laid down criteria that most history teachers could work with, that they accepted. The fact it joined O level and CSE was a good thing, because I mean it was a bit like cricket professional amateurs. I mean, that was just wrong that you somehow divided kids at the age of 14 into that or that. It was that was a good thing. So yeah, a good thing. Never taught GCSE. God, I've written books about it, and I did massive numbers of courses on it. But so I always felt a bit of a charlatan with GCSE, because but never taught it. But there again, never taught O level. Never did O level. Went straight to A level. So perhaps I shouldn't feel too guilty, but GCSE generally feel positive about that. I think that was a good thing.
Do you think it's the positive? Why? Because children enjoyed it more, or simply because it joined together this artificial
development? I think it did join together, united a little bit, and that was no bad thing. Did pupils enjoy it anymore? I think that would be very difficult to say one way or the other. I think there was an awful lot of good teaching at O level, just as there was an awful lot of good old history teaching. I think this is one of the problems with new history, just going back. If I just bring me back to the O level, if I lose that thread of thought. But old history, there were some really good teachers who interested kids massively through chalk and talk, partly because they had nothing else but chalk and talk to use. They didn't have any of the other teaching aids that have come in really since the early 60s, I suppose, or even late 60s. So a lot of good old history, a lot of good GCS, a lot of good O-level history, I think, was taught as well. So the notion that O-level was always taught badly because it had a pretty bad exam, I don't think follows at all. And whether GCSE is taught better than O-level, I think it's examined and tested better than O-level, a better way of testing, and there's more logic to its rationale and its criteria than there ever was with O-level. Whether it's better taught, I think neither wisdom of Solomon for that, and we need rather more, because I'm not sure that there's been any research that I'm aware of that has ever tried to find the answer to the question. But still tend to the view that GCSE in the circumstances of the time, we're talking what, mid-80s I guess, aren't we, was pretty good, a pretty good pragmatic move forward. I mean, it's resulted in, for most of that period, in there being three choices, I guess, which was no bad thing. You did have a degree of choice, but a reasonable degree of choice. Arguably with A-level, there's rather too much choice. Yeah.
Yes. So the three being Modern World, Schools History Project and Social Economics.
Yeah.
Yes. Which has generally fallen away now. So it's mainly...
I think that's no bad thing. I've taught all three. Well, at O-level or CSE, not GCSE, but I've taught those three. I mean, they were the big syllabuses before GCSE, so that's what you taught at O-level or CSE. But social and economic, I always found that was, I didn't like that at all, really. But that was me, other folk loved it.
Would you say that the testing and assessment at GCSE was better? Was that because it gave more scope for students to show in more different ways what they understood?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the O-level was simply write as much as you can or as sensibly as you can about... this, that, or anything else. In what was it, 2.5 hours, something like that. I used to cheat really there, because at Freshville I used to put kids in to do it, often a year before they should, because you could teach them in a year, because they didn't need to know all the stuff. They only had to be able to answer 4 or 5 questions. So if I didn't put them in the June, in there, what would it be? They were year four then, it would be year
10.
So the end of year 10. Or there was a possibility of in November. You could get history out of the way, because there was an awful lot to get the O-level. You had to cram, didn't you, really? You had to learn the stuff and then churn it out. And you could always get kids through in a year, even kids who weren't necessarily very, very able. But that got one subject out of the way, which made it perhaps a bit easier for their other subjects. So that was a pragmatic way forward. CSE, a lot of the assessment there was multi-choice. I feel that in some respects we've gone wrong with multi-choice. The Americans use multi-choice very, very effectively in their system. We've always decried multi-choice, partly perhaps because of CSE, partly because of the American system, and we always say it's not very good, forgetting the fact that the A-level general studies, which is well regarded, I think, has been for years and years, uses multi-choice and very skilled multi-choice questioning. The problem with multi-choice questions, an awful lot of time really needs to be gone through to set a paper where you've got challenging multi-choice questions that are fair across the board. But always felt we, on the history front, we could have experimented down that road rather more than we've ever done, and I think that's a bit sad, given all the research that's been done. No, it's always been denied as a valid way of assessing history, but I think it could be a valid way of assessing some history criteria, knowledge, understanding.
That actually brings me neatly onto the national curriculum, because a number of people in favour of the national curriculum actually believed that a set of very simple tests should be set. The testing regime actually...
clearly very simple then, weren't they, really?
Yes, but that was the original idea.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was seen, the first national curriculum, as a sort of riposte to the skills approach and an attempt to define content. So, what do you think about it? How did it turn out?
Well, in history terms, I'm not sure it was necessarily that, because I think history kind of reached some kind of consensus circa 19 with a blue book and GCSE. A bit of a consensus had been reached, I think, which needed to be reached, and you didn't need to be Solomon to reach that consensus, which was a sensible consensus. So I'm not sure that in history national curriculum was necessarily the content, not the skills. There was an element of that, maybe, but national curriculum, I think, probably had more effect at primary than secondary, in most respects. Secondary, yes, the national curriculum that we got in content terms was not massively dissimilar from the content that already existed, because it was pointed out in quite a lot of research. Spartacus, the interesting publishers, did some interesting research suggesting that there was effectively a national curriculum before the national curriculum in most secondary schools. Indeed, arguably, the national curriculum provided rather more by way of choice than you got previously, which I always thought was a nice irony. It made really not a jot of difference at GCSE, did it? Except that, I may come onto this later, it was a pity, I think, that history didn't become a national curriculum subject down to 16. Every other country, civilised country in the world, I think it's taught to 16. But we allow more than 50% of kids to drop it at 14. That can't be right. But that's probably one of your other questions. But it can't be right that the national curriculum in history allowed that to happen. We should have fought for history to have been in there in some shape or form at secondary to the age of 16. But we lost that fight. You could see the pragmatic advantages of not having kids who were conscripts. You only got the volunteers. So from a pragmatic point of view, I suppose it helped. But from an idealistic perspective, if you believe history to be important, and I do, then I think we should have perhaps put up more of a fight for it to have been in there. So that's a slight negative on the national curriculum, but I think the national curriculum had rather more of an impact at primary than at secondary. Could be wrong in that assumption. I'm speaking from a secondary perspective, so maybe I'm talking nonsense, but I don't think so, because I did quite a lot of national curriculum training for primary teachers. My career had moved on, so for years and years and years, no, at least 4 years, we did courses at St Martin's for primary teachers from mainly Lancashire but occasionally Cumbria, to try and get them up to speed with the national curriculum, and had hundreds, I would have thought, of teachers who went through that training, which was massive. The amount of money that was thrown at national curriculum.
Was that a day per teacher or
more? No, they had 6 weeks. Then they reduced it, but they had loads of time. It was extraordinary, because they could they didn't necessarily all get 6 weeks, but most of them the first courses would get 3 or 4 weeks. I think ultimately then they kind of reduced it to 2 weeks. Just extraordinary. I mean, we made a major mistake at St Martin's, thinking about it now, because the money was there for everywhere, and there was so much money in the first course. We thought we ought to have we had courses for all the modules. So we thought, well, Romans and Saxons and Vikings, York. So we'll go to York for, we'll take all the teachers to York for 3 days. And all right. And then modern day stuff, all London. We'll go to London for a couple of days. So we had, and this was apart from the time that they were coming to the colleges then was.
Was they doing that in their holidays?
Well, yeah, they were doing it, or they got a day off school a week, or we did this at weekends. That actually saved some money, but all the TELF fees were paid. So this was, cheaper than getting supply teachers into where we made the mistake, coming back to the point, was that we should have realised that Egypt and ancient Greece were on the curriculum and take them off to Egypt. And I'm sure the money would have been there. We could have gone to Athens and gone down the Nile every. But anyway, we did. I mean, there was so much money. That was great fun. And they were really delightful, the folk on these courses, because they were there in part to mug up their history. So you were trying to give them a bit of content, but in a kind of interesting way, in the kind of way that they might thereafter teach kids. It's a bit like teaching mothers to suck eggs or something, but I mean it was an interesting interplay, and you could give them good resources, I guess. So I was involved in that to a degree, because I had other primary colleagues at St Martin's who were more involved in that perhaps ultimately than I was. I got a couple of the departments who were more primary trained. I was never primary trained, and although I was on the Primary History Association committee for more years than I care to remember, I've always been really secondary and never pretended to be, apart from perhaps on the Primary History committee. I don't think I pretended too hard there to be other than more a secondary expert than primary.
Did you get any feedback about how effective those courses were for primary school teachers?
They were always well evaluated, but they would be, wouldn't we? Because we were taking them away to York and London and giving them materials. And they ran for a long while. How effective they were in school terms, we never did any follow-up on that score. And of course, there was never any tests of... thankfully there were never any tests of what kids knew or could do at primary history. I mean, the good news was that most children did seem to enjoy primary history for a while, and most teachers did seem to enjoy teaching national curriculum primary history.
That's just an informal feedback,
which I guess I'd get from being on the primary history committee, that must have seen various local studies that were done about kids' enjoyments of subjects, and we had a few advisors there, I think, who'd done a little bit of work. And history invariably was perceived to be one of the greatest successes at primary level, certainly in the 1990s, circa 2000. I lose touch thereafter, so it would be unwise to say anything more. Whether it's, well, I'm sure it's no longer riding the crest of a wave, because it's clearly been cut back and cut back as there's been greater emphasis on literacy and numeracy. But for a while in the 90s, I think primary history, national curriculum history, primary level was again a good thing, but far better than geography. Again, historians were pragmatic, and reasonably good resources were produced. Teachers were pretty well trained. Certainly they were in Lancashire, to a degree that would not be recognised today, the amount of money that was thrown at the national curriculum in the dim and distant past.
Just wanted to take you back to the point you said, why it's important to do history to age 16, because it probably links in with my next question. I mean, you've written that history, in your view, is the memory of society.
Oh, well, that's Marwick, isn't it? I think he probably said that before me, and then there was that was the nature of history, which I crammed for an exam that I had to do in a finals in circa 1970, and I'm sure Marwick pinched it from somebody else, but yeah.
Is that linked into this, why it's important to do it to 16?
Yeah, I think history is what unifies a society. I'm not talking just nation state, I'm talking the various tiers of society, from world through regional through national through various tiers of local societies. Language first and foremost, I guess, after that maybe religion, but I think I'd say that history is should be more important than religion. Dangerous thing, because you've got to work that, and I was at St Martin's College, but I mean, history does help, should help to give a society some kind of reference point to understand itself a little bit. Religion can do the same, but that can be more divisive than perhaps history.
Well, do you think that's become a more problematic issue for British or English society over the last 20 years?
No, I thought your question was interesting. I'm not quite sure why it should be different to England for England than Scotland or Wales or Ireland. I'm not sure where the difference is. I would have thought any society, certainly any nation, has got to have its sense of itself. I would have thought that new folk, well, I would have thought that folk who are native to a particular place should know something of its past, albeit it's an interpretation, obviously, but nevertheless there is a fair amount of consensus about what the shape of Britain's, France's, Germany's, Russia's, America's history looks like. So folk who are born and bred, and probably just as important for folk who come here to have some kind of stability and reference point that they're committing themselves to a society and take on board that society's memory of itself. So I'm not sure that I can see any contradiction there.
The England one, I suppose I was thinking that Scotland and Wales have developed their own history syllabuses now.
Yeah.
But I mean, do you think England has one? A history just as England?
Well, we've got a national curriculum. Which is surely our...
That's British history, isn't it?
Yeah, but there's not a great deal of Scottish. There's not that much Welsh. Because they are a bit tangential and there's probably even less Irish. It tends to be... Oh, the British bits, yeah, would obviously incorporate Wales and Scotland and Ireland. Including Southern Ireland. For much of the period. But I'd hate there to be an absolute just English. I mean, I think that would be... I wouldn't want that at all. No, I'm like I do quite like the United Kingdom, so I'm British in that sense.
Yeah.
But that's purely personal.
Yeah, no, but the thing about going to a 16, was that based on the idea that it's some sense of maturity in being able to accommodate the history of one's own country up to that date?
Well, I just think that, I mean, there's so much history, that's the problem. All history teachers know this, and cramming gallons into an egg cup. A little bit more time to reflect upon the past would, I think, generally be a good thing for society and for the people of society in the future, who I think should know a little bit about where their country has come from, or where their local society has come from, or where their region has come from. Because there's not much awareness of Europe, is there, really, apart from the Nazis, which is all a bit sad, really. That's about it in terms of Europe, and we do belong to a kind of regional bloc. And there's world history out there. And all we know is little bits and pieces. I do think it's rather sad that there wasn't room for a little bit more history to be taught, because if history is the memory of society, if you don't really understand the present and the future of anything without knowing something about the past, and I think that's generally true, then it must be a good thing to know more about the past. It must be a good thing to have a good memory with a lot of good things in there, then it's a pity that the memory of history for more than 50% of kids now, future adults, stops at 14. That's not to say, thankfully, that most won't come to history again. Most will, because they'll get some kind of interest in some aspect of life and then get interested in its history, whether that's music or sport or art or whatever it might be.
So, would you say history's function in schools as being to sort of ignite a spark?
Yeah.
And then something that can go on in one's own adult life later?
Yeah. I mean, the pragmatic in me says, of course, it can put the spark out totally. That is the downside. It depends on how well the subject is taught. But I tend to the view I could be totally and utterly naive, or that the pot's half full rather than half empty, or glass is still half full, so you're okay. Tend to the view that probably history is better taught than most subjects, in part because of my PGCE experience, that to get on a history PGCE course you actually have to be really quite able. There are probably five or six people, and have been throughout my time in history PGCE, in the history PGCE world, where you'd have that choice. You could actually select folk who were able, enthusiastic, to become history teachers in a way that science, maths couldn't. So I suspect that out there are an awful lot of good history teachers who should be able to spark children better than other teachers who aren't as intellectually well equipped, I suspect. I would say that to other teachers. I think that historians probably by and large have got better degrees than most other subjects within schools. I was worried about maths. I always think maths ought to be put more on the spot, and history's always been in danger throughout my 40 odd years of being involved with it. Maths has never been in danger, and yet surely all the maths you ever really needed and that society ever wanted us to need we'd learn by the time we were 11. I agree that the nuclear scientists need a bit more maths than 11-year-olds, but I'm not sure that any of the maths I did post-11 has been of any value in my life thereafter.
Why do you think it's been in danger all these years? Of course, it's never capitulated, but...
You know, in some respects, it's a good thing it's been in danger, because it means that we have to be on our guard, and we don't get complacent, and I think that's quite a good thing. So we've moved a bit with the times. It may not have always gone in my view, in the right direction, but that's life, and that's democracy, and that's nothing wrong with that at all. At least we've had to regroup and rethink, and that's a good thing. But why it's always been in danger? Partly because people can't see any benefit to society. Those in the past, when I was teaching in Sheffield, a lot of the parents of certainly the children who were not perceived to be the academic high flyers would say, well, this is not going to help my son go down the pit, or my daughter work as a secretary, or whatever. So they were arguing from a very blinkered, job-oriented perspective. And I guess a lot of that kind of view still persists. I would defend history more on the memory, society's memory, and it's vital as a kind of mortar to society that we have all got some sense of past identity, a kind of common sense of past identity, in the same way we've got a common language, so that folk who live here for however long have got some kind of things that help bind people together, because I think that's quite important in any society, otherwise it becomes very disparate and folk split up. Now that's you can't sell that very easily in school. It's a kind of high philosophical argument that just won't work at school. So in school you often end up selling it as procedures or skills. These skills that history teaches are absolutely vital. Nothing else does it, and therefore do history because of the skills. So I've said that umpteen times without believing a word of it for much of the time, because I mean if you're doing skills, and the subject seems to me that undoubtedly taught the best skills was Latin, and Latin died a death. It's gone, really. But the skills that you get from Latin surely outrank most of the others. Served Europe quite well for hundreds of years. So I don't think you go down this, but you have to, in terms of trying to sell your subject. But at a philosophical level, I wouldn't be able to sell that very easily. But that's why I still defend history and regard it as important from a kind of high, well, it's not just national, it's a kind of world. If I'm looking at the national, because you mentioned England, but the local sense of locality. You mentioned Wales, Scotland, they've got a sense of locality. as Yorkshire, I'm not sure Lancashire has. Cumbria is none. I have to devise a Cumbrian history syllabus to give the good folk of Cumbria sense of being Cumbrian. They don't feel that at all, I think, because there's no kind of local Cumbria identity. Yorkshire has one. Mm. Yorkshire history course. No.
It's possible.
It is. But there ought to be, there ought to be a bit more European. I mean, perhaps one of the reasons we've no sense of being European is that we've very little knowledge, most folk, of anything to do with Europe, really, apart from the Nazis. And the world, apart from slavery and a bit about America, there's general not much awareness of perhaps ancient Egypt, but that's done in the dim and distant past as far as most people are concerned.
Mm. There's that problem of time.
Mm.
Moving on, I mean, you've written quite a few textbooks for primary history.
Yeah, not as many as I've done for A-level.
No.
I mean, I'm mainly A-level.
A-level.
Well, I've done four or five perhaps for primary, yeah.
So do you think these reflect an improvement in history teaching? Different key stages over the past 20 years. You know, the textbooks have helped improve teaching. They've changed a lot, haven't they?
They've changed a bit. I mean, they've improved. Well, that's not necessarily the content or the illustrations. It's in part perhaps better technology generally. Colour helped a lot. I mean, a lot of the textbooks I first worked with were mainly black and white, but today mainly colourful, certainly for youngsters. Textbooks better? Probably. But it's not just about textbooks, is it, thankfully? Thankfully. You've got to have good textbooks. They're there as a starter. But if teachers at any level ever become totally chained to the textbook, then there's something wrong with the way they're teaching history. You know that. I know that.
But it's about creating your own material.
It is. Absolutely right. That's part of it. But, I mean, the materials are there in textbooks, but you've got to look beyond those. And textbooks just there as occasionally to help and to be cut up and repasted. Primary, they've probably got less time, in fairness, so primary, and they aren't by any means all history specialists, although there's a lot of history specialists in primary schools, although not as specialists as they once were because of the way teachers are now trained at primary. But I guess many want something that's relatively easily accessible. But whether books are better or not, I'm not sure. The primary stuff is, I mean, the stuff I did for Ginn 20 odd years ago, and it worries me, is still, you know, I still get reasonably healthy checks every year, so the books are still selling, and that's 20 odd years down the line, almost.
Well, you could see it positively, either they're very, very good books and people like them, or they just can't get out of ordering the same thing year in, year out.
Yeah. It's a bit worrying.
Yes, we do hear any arguments. People say, well, history never changes, so you don't need new books.
You do hear that argument, yeah. But you're obviously quoting me, my 99%, which I don't ever agree to have said, but I do think there is a kind of core of fact that has to be accepted, otherwise you never get very far very fast in life and not in past life. You have to accept, I think, that some Romans came and a few Saxons came, hardly any really, and fewer Vikings came, but there was and the Normans, well, quite a lot of Normans came, I think, in 1066. You have to accept, and there was a Spanish Armada. You have to accept some dates.
What really matters when it comes to teaching history to under 11s or 11 to 14s? Or is it different to different ages?
Well, it's materials and method, isn't it, I guess. Sorry. It's content and method of teaching. Variety is the spice of teaching life, so plenty of different methods to suit the various needs of the learners. We've all got different styles of learning, so there's loads of different methods you might use, and they can interest or entertain or whatever. With regard to content, I hate most theories about education, but I still quite like the Kieran Egan one, the notion of mythic and romantic and whatever. It still has some appeal. So the really young kids, key stage one, are at the mythic level as far as history is concerned, and therefore history must be taught to them very much as fairy tale, which still strikes me as right, and it's the way I would teach my grandchildren, and did with the kids, I guess. There's the inquiry bit as well, which goes along with that, but that's probably as much through the methods that you use. But the story, the mythic approach, the romantic approach is the kind of Sun Daily Mirror approach, which works for, indeed, most of us most of the time, which is why probably we'd still have a quick look at the Sun or the Daily Mirror, even now, if we were ever presented with one. You know, we could read it very quickly, but we'd have a smile. But I think that tends to be a good way forward with youngsters 8 to 15 and often beyond. So it's the Sun Daily Mirror approach, the bizarre, the larger than life, the strangeness, the odd things that folks in the past have done that tends to entertain, as well as the inquiry approach, which I think, let me not attack SHP too much. I've been a bit unfair there, because I think the inquiry approach is still an absolutely good way forward.
I really would like your view on the trend towards, if you like, me-centred approaches. Something I've noticed in looking at the very recent materials that are being produced is that pupils are asked always to start with themselves and to relate very much the topic to themselves.
We're talking key stage one here, are we?
No, later than that, in secondary, key stage three.
I'm not... I think they should have moved on by at that stage, would be my gut feel. I mean, key stage one is where that might work, and of course that's, I guess, got to be reinforced. I mean, the part of the national curriculum's failure was the notion, I guess, that once you've been taught that, you remember it forever, and therefore you don't need to be taught it again. Well, we all know that that's rubbish, but you do have to kind of be kept on reminded that things you forget, is what I'm trying to say, that being the case, I could see why there might occasionally be some sense in, right, let's return to me at various points, because we've forgotten this along the way, because we've had all this other stuff to remember at the same time. But I'm not sure I'd go along too much with that at
because you emphasise the strangeness
three.
Of history, yeah. The exotic, and the yeah. attraction of the exotic.
Yeah.
On the other hand, some teachers will argue it's important always to have the student's reference point.
Yeah, yeah. The Kieran Egan theory, as I remember it, was that we actually never lose the kind of the mythic, the romantic, the whatever, I suppose if you go back down, then I have nothing against the me. No, I'm not. I think that could be a valid way forward. And indeed, I guess as a secondary teacher, that was often the way you did. Try and link a lot of the content to the kids, the here and now. This is you here and now. This is them in the past. So it's absolutely a valid way forward. I've no problem with that at all.
Looking back on your time as a teacher trainer, what differences have you noticed when you compare the way history teachers approach their work now and when you retired and when you first started? Were there differences, or are they much the same?
I think much the same. I famous last words, but I don't think there were any major differences. My experience the vast majority of people who wanted to be history teachers were committed, enthusiastic, well motivated, determined to interest the kids, and had the potential to be good teachers, which I think most became. Thus the point about most history teachers probably are better than most other teachers. History teacher trainers are fortunate in that position. So that has been true throughout my time with teacher training. Has it changed? I think there's now more emphasis on aims, objectives, the reflective practitioner bit than there used to be, for better, but also for worse. I mean, there is a finite amount of time that all teacher would-be teachers, student teachers, trainee teachers have. And I guess there's a bit of a fear that they might be spending rather too much time on the writing down evaluations and actually preparing materials and coming up with new ideas about how to put particular topics across. It's a bit like police, you know, filling in forms rather than going out and catching criminals, and I think there might have been a bit too much emphasis on one rather than the other, particularly as today would-be teachers, those who have been trained, have got so much more potential with regard to the materials that they can use than you would have or I would have. So in a sense, they need rather more time to prepare because they've got so much more choice of potential material to at their disposal. I mean, the computer makes so much accessible, but does take a lot of time to work out what the best bit of video, the best questions to ask, the best still photograph to stick up. It's just mind-blowing. But you suspect that quite a lot of them are spending all the time just re-examining their navel. But that's just me. Perhaps they have to re-examine the navel. It's me, isn't it, I suppose. So that seems reasonable even for student teachers.
Possibly. So overall, what have been the positive changes that have affected history in schools in your career, and what have been the most negative ones?
Negative. Apart from the fact that, because I think history is vital, perhaps not explain why I think it is as well as I could, but I think it's vital. I'm saddened by the fact that fewer children now do history than did when I was at school, or did, I think, down to the 1980s, so that there's been a fall in the amount of history that's taught, and there's probably been less history taught at primary over the last 10 years than was the case before that. So I'm saddened by that. That might be negative. Otherwise, it's generally positive. Going back to the materials. When I first started teaching, it was largely chalk and talk. I mean, how did you photocopy? It wasn't a photocopier, so you had to Bander or Gestetner.
Yeah.
They didn't work very well. You did your best with them, but chalk was often better than that. And the real positives, well, the photocopier, tremendous. Video, DVD, tremendous. Getting film into the classroom in the early 70s. Sheffield used to have films that you could hire out, the old cine film. But once you got the thing started, if you didn't get it in the time, it was still running, and you couldn't, unless you broke the reel, you were stuck. So you had to kind of, your timing had to be perfect, and you had to order these things weeks in advance. So that was just a nightmare, using film, because there was no video until late 70s, I think, even. And recently the computer and all that goes with that, which incorporates everything really, is just mind-blowingly good. I've continued to go into school even this year. I've done a bit of observation, and what the kind of materials that the teachers can use and the way they are using those materials is super, tremendous. So that's all positive. So I think the material, the people who want to teach are still good. That's not changed very much at all. Certainly not at secondary. I did have a dig at primary. We did use the system of training primary teachers that they had a subject specialism. So you've gotten quite a lot of history specialists into school who would then probably help others to teach history. But with very few specialists now of any description apart from literacy, numeracy, going into primary schools, and I think that's a bit sad. So maybe that's a bit of a negative. But that's just the way that the world has gone, really.
So do you feel optimistic about the prospects for history in the school curriculum?
Yeah. It's still in danger, but it's been in danger throughout my history teaching life, and it'll continue to be threatened. But you do need that struggle to survive, I think, and history has struggled to survive quite well, really, over the last 40-odd years. And I think it is important. I think it'll continue in some shape or form. I hope it continues in pretty much the form it is now. It's better being taught as a separate subject than under a broad humanities umbrella, I think. So in that sense, I am defending SHP as well, because at least they did try and say history is history, and it's not geography, and it's not humanities. Albeit the school time and place one, the 7 to 13, that was quite an interesting integrated approach, which I liked and very much approved of. Albeit generally, I do favour history being taught in splendid isolation.
Thank you very much.
Is that okay?
Yes.